Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, a podcast for physics teachers by physics teachers.
Physics teachers like me, Thomas W.P., a part-time A-level only teacher of physics.
And physics teachers like me, Robin Griffiths, a full-time teacher of physics from year 8 through to year 13.
And physics teachers like me, Patrick Kaplow. I teach AP Physics in Windham, New Hampshire.
Welcome back, Patrick. What a pleasure to have you back on board.
Chaps, thanks for having me.
So here we are. This is the, I like to think of it as the valedictory episode, the end of the season. We've made it. Been a difficult year in the UK with at least two more lockdowns. I've lost count. How was the year for you in Windham, New Hampshire, Patrick?
Well, it's been pretty challenging. I think one of the things, and I'm very curious what you guys are going to say to this. Each individual school district was able to negotiate its own plan for the lockdown. We did not have national or even oftentimes state guidance. So in one town, we would have schools doing 50% in-person instruction. In my school, we had 50% instruction, and the other 50% were Zooming in. So that was our plan. What was it like in the UK? Was there a mandate from the government that kind of said it's going to be like this?
It was very variable, I think. It was some schools, I think, as far as I gather, literally just shut down and did very, very little, if anything at all. Some just set work, you know, had worksheets that they sent home. Some switched to full online provision. Our school went fully online over a weekend, which we were reminiscing about happily the other day with sort of slightly hysterical laughter. But, you know, one way or other, we muddled by. But I think it was very similar that it was kind of left up to the individual schools concerned.
Yeah, certainly this year, a local sixth form college has just 2 year groups in it, juniors and seniors, I think we'd call them. And they had them on alternate days over 2 weeks. So Monday, the whole of the juniors would come in, year 12. Tuesday, the whole of the seniors, year 13, would come in and they'd alternate. And then on the off days, they were doing big lectures. So I know the physics were lecturing 120 kids at once online, just lecturing them. My school, in this second year of the COVID pandemic, we got lucky, really. We never had to send a year group home. I know other schools, like a local school, had an outbreak just this last week, and my daughter's off for 2 weeks. But we haven't had to send a year group home, but we've always had one or two kids with COVID and 10 or 12 kids isolating the whole caboodle. But Robin's right. I think, again, it's down to the schools, how they manage it.
So, Patrick, my question in return for you is we have this slightly odd situation now where most of the country has been vaccinated, but the people who haven't are the younger age groups. And so where the COVID cases are really ballooning is in those young age groups. So schools have been particularly hard hit by cases. But of course, now most people are vaccinated. The rate of hospitalizations and deaths is way down, but the rate of cases is going up. So we've got this slightly perverse situation where schools are shutting down quite a lot towards the end of the year. And the government have just said no more bubbles. From mid-August, so basically beginning of next school year, they're just saying, well, we'll just get on with it and see where the cards fall. What's the situation in America?
It's very similar. You know, it's a bit concerning simply because the numbers seem to indicate that some of the variants are increasing infection rates. And, you know, we saw the same huge depression in cases last summer. But the difference is this summer there's a vaccine available. You know, about half of all Americans are vaccinated, and in the Northeast, where I'm from, it's closer to 2/3, and we're approaching 80% in New Hampshire. So there's a part of me, you know, it's a big, very diverse place. I always compare it, you know, again to like Europe. You know, you can say you're in the UK, but how's Romania doing? And it's probably going to be a different situation there. There are parts of the United States that, you know, are at 30% vaccination rates. And so, you know, I think going forward in the Northeast, it's going to probably be business as usual. Whether that makes sense from our WHO and CDC perspective, maybe not. But I think Americans the pandemic may not be over, but they're done thinking about it. It's really where we are.
Had enough, yeah. I think that's where we're at as well, actually, because I think there's a lot of people who've just got so fed up, and the complexity of the rules often has just left people bamboozled. So people are just saying, oh, well, you know, I'll just get on with life and see what happens.
So enough pandemic chat. I think that's 5 minutes is plenty. One of my great many regrets about the pandemic, one of them was that we missed coming out to see you in New Hampshire.
I remember that.
That was a big blow. And I was wondering where, I know it didn't coincide with your infamous trebuchet challenge, but I've been wondering if you did the trebuchet challenge under pandemic.
We did not. Did
you?
No,
you did.
It was,
not.
It was the timing didn't work, and we could have rescheduled it in the spring, but there was never a point, fall or spring, where the infection levels were really low. I mean, we had really low levels in the summer, but they started to really increase by October. And part of the event involves the kind of festivities and the cookouts, and it just didn't make sense. It seemed really irresponsible to kind of just charge forward and schedule it. So we took a year off.
It's disappointing because I had this vision of you. I know you dress up as a knight in shining armor and stand in your castle and they lob balloons at you. I had this vision of you dressed as a coronavirus and them sending little sachets labeled vaccine at you.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because for somebody who's just listening and hasn't heard the podcast before, have you seen the game? Trebuchet. What, Patrick, could you just briefly, for any of our listeners who have come to the podcast more recently, explain your trebuchet challenge, because it is a classic.
Wow. For me to explain a trebuchet to listeners, it's basically a gravity-powered catapult. I think a lot of people understand the word catapult and not trebuchet. There are a couple of other differences. There's a counterweight typically that falls and a throwing arm that whips around. And there's usually a sling involved. The catapult typically is arrested and sends a projectile out of it. So these things are, you know, 2 to 3 meters in height. So that's the scale that we're working with. And those are hard limits. And these are big machines, right? And kids are operating them. It's quite a spectacle.
You forgot to mention that you build a castle, dress as a knight in armor, and stand in it with your shield. And they win by hitting you.
Absolutely. The taunting aspect is really a huge part of it. Think Monty Python. Your mother smells like elderberries.
Your mother was a hamster. And how far away are you in your castle?
Yeah, so we are 35 meters is the... So we have a circular firing line. And there'll be... So the radius of the circle is 35 meters to the center of this little 12-sided castle. And I'm on one of the walls, essentially on the parapet. And this thing is just made out of plywood. But we've made it in years past with, I don't know what you'd call them. They're building tubes for pouring concrete footings. And we make these like turrets and things like that. But yeah, it can get pretty complicated with our design kind of structure.
We'll post a video so that anybody who fancies setting up a trebuchet challenge at their school can work out what's going on and do that. It's the sort of thing that I think David Cotton might well get into, don't you, Thomas?
Ah, what a brilliant link, Robin. You are such a pro. Yes, I was mentioning to you before in the green room, before we came online, that I had to do a big shout out to David Cotton because, dear listeners, don't want to give you any ideas. David sent me a present. I obviously talked happily about my travelling microscope and what to do with it, and I said, I have a practical, not only that, I have a textbook for you. So, David, thank you so much for the textbook, which I have already used in anger. Send it to my two top kids with the proof crossed out. And they have both managed to do the proof, so they're going to do the experiment when we get back, which is working out the refractive index of glass by using a travelling microscope to measure the bottom, top, and the apparent depth with the glass on. And he also slipped in a surprise gift based on our ways to teach .. light, a little tiny board with three coloured LEDs, red, green, blue, and the button for each, and you can shine it on the wall and make the three primary colours mix in any way you like. Absolutely delightful. So, David, thank you very much. And David's very keen to come back in the podcast, so he will be back in season 4, I guess, when we're back.
He can report on how his trebuchet went.
He's lucky, isn't he? Because you two are both are not working at the moment. You've broken up. Scotland has broken up. My school still has 2 weeks to go.
I just got back actually from the Yorkshire Dales, where I was doing Duke of Edinburgh. Award, which was phenomenal. We actually finished at a castle there, but the weather was somewhat erratic, to say the least. And I did want to ask, Patrick, because we've been seeing some sort of apocalyptic scenes of northwestern United States, mainly Canada, Vancouver, where temperature's been up to about 50 degrees. And I noticed, as Thomas calls it, in the green room beforehand, i.e. before we press record, you were saying that it's been stupid hot in New Hampshire. Is this...
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And the humidity, it's like in the tropics. It's really, really strange. The humidity level and the heat are just oppressive. And it's not common for folks to have aircon here. And so we're just suffering through it, you know, trying to find watering holes and swimming pools and things like that to beat it.
So going up and plunging into the waterfalls in the White Mountains and stuff like that.
Yeah, I wish. No, more things local. I think there are deaths. I'm quite sure there are deaths out in the West. And they're almost like, you know, especially coastal, Pacific coastal Northwest there. It's a lot like Great Britain. It's typically, you know, they get a fair amount of precipitation. It doesn't get too hot and they're just not used to it and unprepared for it.
But I thought all American houses had like a aircon plant in the basement and you have the whole house air-conned.
No, I was just saying that it's pretty expensive to have that fitted out for your house. I'm just guessing, depending on what you get in the size of the house, it's $10,000-$15,000 for that kind of stuff. And so when you live in cold, you know, typically, you know, mean temperature, colder climates like New Hampshire, we don't have them. We they're not built in. They're starting to become more common, you know, as the climate changes.
Every time I speak to you, Patrick, you shatter one of my stereotypes about America.
Well, you know, it's a mixed bag. You can find the same kind of things in Great Britain, right? I mean, and so when you, it's just a question of ratios. are there more, there might be, I'd be willing to bet there are more crazier ideas out here, more out of the box kind of folks. That's the very kind way of saying it.
But Thomas, you've got in your kitchen, because you basically had a ground source or an air source heat pump installed?
We have an air sourced inverter, which is not a heat pump.
Was it put in originally as a heat pump and you can invert it to basically make...
Yeah, so I was teaching engineering for the first time at A-level. And I worked out... So I have a big kitchen, which we extended, and it doesn't have any... hot water underwater, you know, normal central heating for some reason, because we were stupid and young when we built the extension. So it only has under four wire heating, which when we put in we thought great, but actually now electricity costs three times what it cost when we were young. And I worked out it was costing me 70p a day to heat that room. It was just insane. And it was beyond for hours and the room would never be really hot. And I was teaching engineering and looking at this going, oh wow, I can get a heat pump in. The coefficient of performance is 4, and even if it's on the same amount as the floor, it'll cost me a quarter. So we got one put in, and then of course it heats the room up in 10 minutes, and it saved us so much money, just so much money.
But also on it, you've got this ability to switch it, and then it basically pumps heat the other way.
Yeah, and in the summer, on the really hot days, I mean, you know, 35 degrees, Patrick, wow. Like that's a very, very, very hot day here and rare. Whew. Then we can turn it on and have a cool kitchen. That is a real treat. So that's physics teaching for the win. I was thinking about this when I was, you know, funnily enough, we were contacted by a friend of the podcast, James De Winter, after the Vernier episode. And he was saying, do you think that's something we really need to teach, reading a Vernier? And I was thinking when I replied to him, the only thing I've used apart from this coefficient of performance in the last 10 years from what I actually teach is a vernier, which I use all the time at home in my DIY. It's the only thing, nothing on the spec at all I use in my everyday life. That's something I wanted to talk to you about. I mean, how relevant is your AP to everyday life? If you don't go and be a professional engineer and you don't go and be a physics teacher, how much is the stuff in AP physics used in life?
If I'm being honest, Thomas, I think that's kind of a loaded question. I mean, I personally thought about it on a hiking trail going down a long piece of granite slab thinking, okay, let's think about this in terms of, coefficients of friction and normal forces. And where am I going to maximize the frictional force, or how am I going to? Because I get nervous and I want to slink down and slide down on my backside. But if you, you know, it's very easy to think about it in terms of an inclined plane. And I've had plenty of students say things like, you know, at the maybe Christmas break, they'll say, I started thinking about physics quite often. I think that mechanics, which is typically taught first as a first year course, does manifest into many normal everyday activities. There might not be like perfect examples of it where you just are using a tool that you've learned to use in your physics class, like calipers or something. But certainly in a second half of the curriculum, when we get into circuit theory, I mean, that has many applications. And just using a digital multimeter, you know, we go out into our cars. I know this might be strange. Our 17-year-olds are driving cars. And they're oftentimes secondhand or even thirdhand cars that have windows or sunroofs that don't work or radios that don't work. And oftentimes when you pull the fuse on those things, it's just a blown fuse. And so we'll do resistance checks on fuses and with multimeters. And the kids think it's like the coolest thing ever. So, you know, in a first year physics class, I do think that there are, you know, myriad opportunities for applications of physics to kind of touch everyday life. I really do.
I worship you, Patrick. That's such a good answer. I think it kind of it was a loaded question. And I think if you ask that to any subject, a lot of any subject you don't use. And it's all about, I think, teaching the kids to be able to learn and, you know, and giving them the skills. But you've actually said, no, we go out and actually use a multimeter in anger on a car. I'd never do that. We do have some 17-year-olds driving to school. I wouldn't think as many as you, but I would never think to do that.
Well, Thomas, I'm looking at the bike wheels and things hanging behind you.
Yes.
And when you stand up and get out of the saddle, you know, do you think about optimizing the torque that you're generating on the crank? Do you think about gearing ratios when you're out on a ride? I think it's easy to think about those things.
I don't actually. I think more about the biology. The only physics thing I think about is the friction in the drivetrain. I get that very well lubricated. Mm. But I don't think about the gearing ratio because I'm always thinking about pedaling as fast as I can, as in cadence wise, which is biology. It's putting the load on your heart, not your legs.
Thomas, one more. When you're approaching a stop sign in your Tesla and you watch the green line charge the batteries back up, do you ever think about electromagnetism? Or when you're going down a hill at a constant rate and you're actually charging the batteries, do you think about conservation of gravitational potential energy into electrical energy? Because I think that's pretty cool stuff to think about.
I do think that's cool. But I do think I'm a physics teacher and I ought to be thinking that, really, but I don't use it. I do think that's super cool, and I have thought if I ever, because yes, dear listener, I am lucky enough to have a Tesla. If I did take it on a holiday to the Alps, which I love going to the Alps, summer or winter, I wouldn't want to charge it at the top because then when I came down, I'd have to use my brakes. Whereas if I have it at the top, sort of half empty, on the way down, I won't need to use the brakes at all because of the induction braking, which is fantastic. That's a brilliant practical, actually, induction braking. We don't have the kit for it, but when I was in my first ever teaching job, someone came in. He had little discs of aluminium, and you put an electromagnet across them, and you just held them in, and you clamped them in a clamp in a between two blocks, and you tied a bit of string around the axle, and you could put weights on it, and it slowly fell to the floor and spun up the disc. And then if you turn the electromagnet on, the disc would run slower because of induction braking. And the variables were fantastic. So you could change the weight, you could change the current, you could change the number of coils. So fantastic experiment. I think I'd forgotten all about that. I may have to get my tech department on to making me some aluminium disc because it was a brilliant investigation.
Well, you don't need an EV to, I mean, hybrids have this technology. So I think that a lot of people actually do have access to these vehicles or starting to. It's becoming really common. I don't know what it's like in the UK, but I'm guessing, you know, in the US, probably 10% of vehicles are hybrids, at least. I'm thinking it's much higher in the UK.
Well, I mean, in the podcast, Patrick, 2 out of 3 of us have got a Tesla.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm doing with my time, frankly. I have to say, one of the things actually we're talking about things where we think about physics, I often think because I use this quite a lot as an example when I teach work and power and things like that and use it quite simplistically. About the idea of kind of running up the stairs. So I sort of say, oh, you know, so-and-so in the class, you know, if we both ran up the stairs, she would be much quicker up the stairs than I am, because she's young and fit and I'm old and fat, and that's the way it goes. Basically, we'd both be increasing our gravitational store of energy by the same amount. You know, we'd both be doing that. But, of course, you know, she's doing it faster, so she's more powerful than me, and that would be my simplistic view of it. But, of course, there's this whole idea of efficiency in there, which I think is always really interesting, that basically the human body is like any machine, and the more you push it, the more inefficient it becomes. So, in fact, actually, she might go twice as fast as me, but that doesn't mean she's twice as powerful. In fact, she's probably 2.5 times more powerful, because she's also taking on board the inefficiency that comes with moving even faster, and so on and so forth. So we kind of have this idea of the body as a machine. That's something I think about quite a bit.
Now, again, that's biology, but I used to do that. But I think you're more powerful, because I always used to do the classic, I'll give £5 to the person in the room who's the most powerful coming up the stairs. And you sound like you think you're the same weight as this child. Well, I know I'm double the weight of anyone in the class, so I can almost walk up the stairs, and then we work it all out, they're more powerful. So, and I used to teach on the second floor, so that's like 4 flights of stairs, and we used to get the athletes to sprint up the stairs. Probably can't do it now under health and safety 10 years later, but then I used to run up the stairs, and you know, I'd always be more powerful. I think you're right, the efficiency there is good calculation, but how would you work that out? You'd have to talk to a biologist to get an idea of the efficiency of the human muscles. It's a bit beyond me.
Well, absolutely. It's one thing I was, particularly because, you know, when you go to the gym and things like that, people say, oh, well, you know, if you walk 10 kilometres, you use the same amount of energy as if you run 10 kilometres, which is patently nonsense, because when you run, your efficiency is way lower, and you use a great deal more energy doing that. So that's why running is better exercise than walking, I guess.
Yeah, the end argument of that is that it's the same amount of energy to cycle 10 kilometres, which is patently ludicrous.
But I agree with Patrick absolutely about electricity, so I'm not scared of electricity. I talk to lots of people who are really competent DIY people who will happily, you know, plumb in a bath or a sink or something like that, which I balk at, because I think you actually have to have some real skill to be able to do those compression joints and things like that. But they would happily do all that sort of stuff, but say, oh, electricity, I won't touch that, because they have this sort of idea of mystery about it. But I think because I study physics, I kind of know the idea of the principle that you use a bigger wire if it's going to take more current. I can work out the ratios that needs to be, you know, and I can read the specs and understand the specs for what size of wire I need for what application, and so on and so forth. So I've never been particularly scared of it. And then, you know, safety, obviously, turn the whole thing off before you start, pretty much covers it. And then do what you need to do.
Welcome to the Electricians Podcast. I'm the same. I didn't do electricity for years but my theory was, if I get plumbing wrong, I get wet, and if I get electricity wrong, I get dead. So I didn't do it for years. But actually, I now do it by using the what you said there. I think it is something. As long as you know that, you know. Actually, this is another way I've used my physics. Is I draw out a circuit diagram first, and then go and wire it up, and then I've got a friend. Luckily, I've got a friend who's an electrician who checks everything over for me, and then I go and do it. All good examples we should use, and we've done a podcast on this, haven't we, on making STEM and new STEM, about giving physics context. So what episodes did you enjoy this year, Robin? It seems like the year has gone past so fast. I really enjoyed the one we did with David.
Ways to teach sound.
He was so enthusiastic. It was just, I was buzzing after that. That was a lot of fun.
It's a tough year to be hyped about teaching, right? I feel like I've been constantly battling sliding into apathy, right? I just, like, it's just a year that didn't draw me in. And I don't know what the kind of rhythms were like. We would go into full remote, and at the very beginning, I felt very enthusiastic. I was like, we're in this crazy time. Everybody's got to step up and do their part. I have this civic responsibility to do, you know, to make this fantastic. And then by like March, I was just exhausted, and I didn't feel the same way. I felt like kids in some cases were taking advantage of, you know, at home assessment and things like that. And I was just tired out.
I felt the hybrid model that you and Robin had to do, where you have kids in the room and kids online at the same time. I thought that would be very hard and demotivating, just because you know you're not giving them the same experience. I was lucky enough that we were always in school once we came back, apart from, or always at home. There was no intermediate. But I hear you. I mean, I think my problem with the year sevens is I never had that solid getting them where I wanted them, you know, getting them sorted. I was always playing catch up because they were just becoming nice, and then we had lockdown. They came back and they were a bit feral, and they hadn't had year six in primary school. They never really settled down, and because I knew I wasn't going to have year seven next year, I kind of never got to grips with it, never sorted it out. And I have this, it's that imposter syndrome, isn't it? I feel, oh, I should never on-call a child because I'm an experienced teacher and I never on-called. So I had kids in there I should have on-called, which is when a senior teacher comes and collects them and takes them away. And I never did that. And then they were never a problem. They were but argumentative or not doing what I thought. And I think looking back, if I'd on-called them early on and made that line in the sand, I might have avoided lessons later on. The same mistakes I would have made in my first year of teaching.
This was where I looked for a silver lining, because I think it was kind of like going back to day one in teaching, in that we were all well outside our comfort zone. And as we happily pontificate to the kids all the time, well, outside your comfort zone is where you learn the most. So I think, I've learned a lot this year about teaching online, about the use of online tools. And I think we've talked about it with you, Patrick, before as well. Some of the online tools that we develop, some of the tactics and strategies that we develop for online teaching, those aren't going to go away. Those are going to be with us for life. So, this is kickstarted, and now it's kind of consigned, hopefully, touch wood, to history. The benefits are there to be realized, and the pain is a distant memory, and hopefully we can move on. Having name dropped my D of E earlier, and this will stop Thomas cutting it out as well, the thing that struck us all about this group, and this was a group of year 11s who had postponed their D of E expedition for a year, so they planned this over a year ago. But basically, they just went out there and they absolutely bossed it. It was throwing it down with rain. Horrible, horrible weather. They were carrying wet kit around the countryside, 10, 15 kilo packs up and down the Yorkshire Dales. And there was no moaning or whinging or anything. They just got on with it because they're just that much more resilient because of this. And so there are silver linings to this, which we will now get to reap the benefits of, I think.
That's a very nice story, Robin. Something you said there made me think, what have you used from last year? Because I've gone full circle now and I've been teaching stuff that I was teaching in full lockdown last year.
No, I mean, I kind of was fairly consistent in terms of, and I think we talked about it in a previous episode. There were some new tools that I used that will stay with me. I continued to use them throughout the kind of extended, lockdown, if you will. And I won't use all of them. Certainly, I don't want to. I mean, in person, there's something about the kind of human connection that happens when you're in a classroom with other students. But certainly, some of the tools, assessment methods, I thought I improved in the pandemic. And to be honest, I think education, although I don't think anybody would argue and say that this year's education was on par with what it's always been, I think it was at a lower level. But it does strike me as a little strange that it took this pandemic to force educators like us to see the new technologies that were available. We were effectively forced to do it. I mean, if there was no pandemic, I wouldn't have discovered many of these things that do benefit students. And so, there's the silver lining that we've discussed in previous episodes.
And I think also that there's a mandate for school leaders, I think, and I don't know how school leadership works in the States, Patrick, so maybe you can elaborate on this, but some of the professional development and Thomas and I have laughed about this quite a lot, some of the professional development stuff we do in the UK is just awful. And really, it doesn't really help teachers to teach better. And I think that this is one of the things that perhaps we can take from this, that we've been forced to look at new ways to teach. We've all been forced to do new things. And there is some sense that we need to kind of collate that, think about that, research some of the implications of that, and present that to teachers as potential ways to develop their practice. And I hope that happens. I really do.
I do too, Robin. And I'm going to think of you at my first professional development session in the fall when, it's like nothing has happened,
Draw a picture of a teacher. Yeah. They've got big ears to listen with. Oh, yes. We've all been there.
I just say, I just want a student that wants to learn. That takes learning seriously. I don't care about anything else. I just want to respect the learning process. I don't care about their ability. I don't care about what they wear. I just want them to respect the process and try. That's all I care about.
How did you draw that? That's very abstract.
Well, we were sitting socially distanced in a lab with it projected, the sessions projected onto a screen and sort of yelling each other across the room. I mean, it was quite amusing.
Yes, well, that was like that. I always hope to get on the same table as one of the art department because they always do a really good job of that. And everybody goes, oh, look, yeah, your learning tree looks a lot better than ours. Oh, yeah.
We were in silos, so we were just in the science silo. Ooh. In a science lab, and art were somewhere else in the art, in an art room.
Yeah, I think most schools that I've been in, they've learned not to do that because they know that scientists, by their very nature, are quite sceptical people, and they tend to question quite a lot. And it's not really how you're supposed to approach CPD sessions, I don't think. Anyway, I think we're veering a bit off topic, and I'm getting in danger of being fired before I've even started my new job. So I will.
So yeah, you two both have a new start next year. Robin, you're head of sixth form, head of the juniors and seniors, and Patrick, I believe you are changing school, going to teach in a different state.
Yeah, that's correct. The states in New England are quite small, and so this is a similar commute for me, and just across the state line.
So into Vermont or Massachusetts?
Into Massachusetts, yeah. The name of the town is Billerica, and they just built a new school. The town's been there for a long time and has had a school, but they have a new, brand-new facility, and one of the prior physics teachers, I'd kept in touch with, and we'd been colleagues for maybe about a decade, and he's going into school administration. And so, yeah, he pinged me, towards the end of the school year. And, I was really ready for a change. It wasn't just the pandemic, although I think the pandemic probably had some part to play in my thinking about it. You know, I don't know how you feel about this, but I almost had this fear somewhere inside that I just didn't want to be that guy who had taught in the same school for 20 or 30 years. It's not that I don't respect that. There are some wonderful teachers out there who have been in the same place for a long time. For some reason, I think I'm just a restless soul, maybe by nature, or I just didn't want to feel like that, that I had only seen one building, one organization. So that was really another motivating factor for me to kind of jump ship. So
before I answer that question, I just have a couple of clarifying cultural things here. What is a short commute in America?
I don't think I said a short commute. I said a similar commute. A short commute, I think most people would say 10, 15 kilometers pretty reasonable commute, I think, for most people.
Okay, and school administration, is that what I would call the principal and the deputy principal?
Yes, principal or assistant principal. Or we also will have like department heads, I think call them.
Faculty heads, department heads. And is the trebuchet competition going to travel with you, or does that belong to your local town?
So that's a great question. Before I taught in Wyndham, I taught at another New Hampshire school, and we did the trebuchets there. I might wait a year or two before I introduce it. We talked about it earlier. I don't think it's a great pandemic activity. I hope that the worst of it is behind us, but I don't think it's over, and I don't think it will be for next academic year. We'll still have issues to deal with.
I think it's interesting. You're absolutely right in what you say, Patrick. I think there's a rare, and I think it is quite a rare group who can be inspirational all the way through for 30 years at the same school, the same procedures, and they constantly challenge to reinvent themselves, and they do a fabulous job. But you also get, and the stereotype that you referred to there, the person who's been there for 30 years, a bit misanthropic, jaded. What was it, James de Winter, that he used the term a velvet-lined rut, which I thought was a very, very good way of putting
it. Great line.
You're absolutely right. So I think, if you think you need that challenge, you probably do. And well done. Many congratulations for doing that. That's great. And the Massachusetts school system has a huge reputation, I think, worldwide for the stuff it's done.
It's tops in the U.S. Mm. And, from scoring perspective, actually, New Hampshire is second. So it's not like I'm going from the dregs up to the tippity top. they're on par with, most European countries in terms of scores. It's when you average in some of the lower performing states that the U.S. really performs poorly on the average.
You both got something to look forward to next year. Well, my challenge at the moment is, since Matt came, the numbers doing A-level physics has been shooting up, but not the numbers of physics teachers, this classic problem. So we look like we might have 25 kids doing A-level next year, which for us is great, but we've got enough kit for the A-level practicals, max 16 in the class. Mm. So I'm not sure how we're going to do that. Plus, you know, marking 25 papers, goodness me. I mean, I'm hearing all the people who are teaching sixth form colleges, the hollow laughs as they have to do 150 UCAS references and 150 papers. But for me, 25 is going to be a huge increase.
Well, I think two groups of about 12 or 13 each sounds to be solve your problem. So it's
yeah, just speak to the timetabler. That would be my suggestion, but I feel they think we don't have enough teachers for that, the endless problem, and it wouldn't change the amount of marking.
No,
it?
That's true, but I think if you've got those if you've got two groups timetabled rather than one, I think that does definitely make a difference.
It softens the blow, doesn't it, because you feel you're being paid to do it appropriately.
I think particularly if they're only providing kit for 16, I think I'd probably lean on the fact that...
And only 16 because we went up to 16 last year and 2 years ago. No, last year, and I said, look, we've got 16 kids. We must, a third of the money they get must be for physics, and I can't do it, so I need you to buy me some kits. So we got some sort of, yeah, we got some more vibration generators and that, so we could have four groups of four for the some of the required practicals. But I bet you out in some of the sixth form colleges, there's classes of 30 with one teacher. I can't imagine that.
Yeah, I think the some of these schools have been limited. I don't know if you have the same in the States, Patrick, but when they designed the schools, they of course, you know, did them on the minimal possible spec that they could get, and so a lot of the labs have been designed to do 30 and no more. So now they're sort of happily saying, and I know there are some sixth form colleges which have English classes and things like that up in the 40s, but here, you know, the labs literally cannot fit them in, sort of been hoisted by their own petard there, I think, whatever a petard is, but there you go.
Yeah, the lab I teach in is really weird. It's a square with the one quarter chopped out. It's the head faculty's office and a hot water tank, so it's L-shaped, and in the little bit of the L we have four tables for doing practical work, and then in the other bit we have 20 chairs and desks, so you can fit 20 kids in there.
Yeah, we have some state caps on lab sciences at 24 for safety is the argument.
True. I mean, I couldn't imagine running a lab session for 40 kids. It'd be bedlam. So
you can't support them and you can't see how they're doing. It's hard enough. I found it very hard of 16 just to see how they're doing. Again, I'd probably need to get someone from a sixth form college on. If you are a listener who's made it this far into the podcast of us not really talking about physics much, and you have some strategies for teaching a large class of A-level, it would be very interesting for poor souls like me to know how you manage it. So please get in touch. Contact at thephysicsteachingpodcast.com.
Or you can tweet us at physicstp.
Or there's a contact form on every page of the website, the.physicsteachingpodcast.com. Well, I mean, it's a physics teaching podcast. I'm not sure we talked about physics teaching very much, but it's been the end of another year. As Patrick, you say, it's been a pretty difficult year. I feel I'm ready for the holiday. I'm part-time. I've got 2 weeks left. You two, I look at very jealously. You've finished the year. Yes, let's wind it up. Let's wrap it up for the season. We should do some thank yous, Robin, shouldn't we?
So, yeah, first thanks should go to Patrick, who was one of our first international guests and opened up the American market for us. You know, it's sort of like, yeah, we're the Beatles and you were, I don't know, who was it? I don't know. You were like New York Giant Stadium or something.
Yeah, just mad British mania.
And we should thank all our guests through the year. So it's been super. I mean, David Cotton particularly, who was excellent. The experts we've had on different topics. Carol Kemrick was great fun again. We must get her on again. Friend of the podcast, James De Winter. Mark Robinson with his amazing marking machine. And that it'll be interesting getting back, because almost immediately some sixth former worked out you could paste in the entire works of Shakespeare and get the question right. And then instead of that being catastrophe, I think he started working with Mark on the marking machine. So that was the podcast making some good. Mark Wally, who came on. So there's just so many fantastic guests, and we're always keen to have more.
Please do get in touch if you would like to talk about anything. If just something you've heard and you take issue with, or you think, oh, I've got something to add to that, it would really be lovely to hear from you. You don't have to do a full podcast. If you're nervous about even appearing on the podcast, you can just let us know, drop us a line, contact us, and we will share your thoughts with a grateful physics community.
I would like to thank you, Robin. I know you've had quite a challenging year yourself. We have muddled through. I think we very nearly stopped on 100, but the outpouring from the listenership of joy, no.
Relief.
Some people did contact us saying, please continue. And that is so motivational. I mean, we've had many emails over the year, and I cannot tell you how nice it is to get out of the blue an email from a physics teacher saying how much they appreciate the podcast. It is so motivational. And that is really why we carry on. It's because when we get emails like that, we feel we're making a difference.
Yeah, and I would say that to experienced teachers who are listening. It's just that way of, you know, when you were training and you were starting off, so many of our emails come from people who are young in service in teaching, who are starting out in their practice, and they find these little tips and hints and things that we just consider part of our everyday practice and almost, you know, part of the landscape. They're so, so grateful for those. So that's where it's a great way of sharing your practice. So please do let us know, because you can always put it on your professional development form and say that you've shared something with the physics teaching community via the podcast. It's perfectly legit to do that. And it would be lovely to hear from you. There is one more person to thank, of course. And we talk about the heavy lifting on this. There is a huge amount of heavy lifting on the podcast, because there's the website and the fixing some of the technical issues we've had over the years. Editing this thing is an absolute beast. And sometimes some of the technical problems that we had, like when we had Paul the technician, our lovely technician, on, and we had a 10-second delay, and he was brilliant and you were brilliant sorting it out. And it actually came out sounding like something like a normal conversation, even though it was slightly bizarre. And so thank you so much for all you have done. You have been brilliant.
Well, thanks, Robin. It's been a pleasure mostly. And the 100 was a bit of a hurdle to get over. But now we've sort of eased off a bit. I'm much more motivated. Summer break. We'll be back. Hopefully you'll be in touch with Alom. We'll get Alom on. We're definitely going to do a ways to teach .. So if any listeners have any ideas for that, we have our expert. But if anyone has any ideas for ways to teach .. please get in touch through the usual ways. Otherwise, it's probably time to end it for this academic year. So without further ado, I'd just like to thank you very much, Patrick.
Such a pleasure to chat with you guys. I really hope that you have a wonderful summertime and recharge those batteries along with all of the listeners who really, really deserve it after this past academic year.
And thank you hugely for keeping me going. Thank you very much, Robin.
Thanks, Thomas. See you next year.
Next year. Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast. And special thanks this week to Patrick and everyone who's been a guest on the podcast. The podcast is presented by me, Thomas WP, with Robin Griffiths, and produced and edited this week by Robin, with me maybe doing the show notes, my least favourite job on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next year.